Thank you again for agreeing to talk to us. If we can go back to the very beginning, after the power sharing deal has been signed and the fanfare is over and you walked into your new office, what were the challenges that you faced in the very beginning?
Well, you see, this is a government formed against a background of conflict. So it was not like, as you can say, a coalition of the willing. It was a coalition that was imposed by circumstances that were existing in the country at that time. Therefore, you know, there was a lot of tension in the country, a lot of fears and suspicions among the coalition partners. And we had now the responsibility of leading this coalition government. A president who was the head of state and sharing power in terms of running the government. We were the co-partners, equal partners, and we were sharing power on a 50-50 basis. A cabinet that was split right in the middle, 50% from the PNU, that's the Party of National Unity, and 50% from the ODM, that's my party. And there was supposed to be portfolio balancing. And as you know, we had argued for a long time how to balance portfolio to share power, particularly when it came to the so-called strategic ministries. But my first challenge was to remove the divide so that we have one uniform government, that you don't have this tug of war of ODM and PNU in the government, so that you have one cabinet. Because my responsibility as Prime Minister was spelled out in the agreement to supervise and coordinate functions of the government, including government departments and so on. So the first cabinet meeting shared by the president and assisted by me, they made it clear that there were not two governments. There was going to be one government and that ministers needed to work together as one team. Now, as you know, we had a cabinet of 42 ministers. Ministries had been split in order to satisfy the demands of both sides of the coalition. So it was a very bloated cabinet. And I, after consulting with my team, strategic team, I proposed to the president that we, in order to have efficiency in the workings, that we divide the cabinet into sectors. So there's infrastructure, social sector, financial sectors, productive sectors, and service ministries. So, and this was agreed, and I worked it out in my office, but we classified these ministries, like roads, transport, housing, energy, water, and so on, infrastructure, ministries. Then there's the security sector ministries I'm talking about. Those that do internal security, for example, defense, the one that deals with home affairs, which is prisons and so on, all these security sector ministries. Then the other ones are reproductive sector ministries, which is like, for example, industrialization, agriculture, several others. The service sector, education, health, and so on. So we divided this cluster, these ministries, and that way, and all the committees. So these were now committees, mm-hmm. subcommittees of the cabinet,
yeah.
and all the committees of the cabinet are chaired by the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
So I would chair the meetings before the main cabinet. Main cabinet usually met on Thursdays,
mm-hmm.
but the preparatory meetings were held on Tuesdays in the office of the prime minister. So if a ministry has got business to be presented to the cabinet, a memorandum,
yeah.
I wanted to present, these memos were submitted to my office, and I had a secretary dealing with it. Then they would report to the committee meeting under my chairmanship. And in the committees, we allowed ministers to come with their permanent secretaries and also their experts,
mm-hmm.
so that they could explain in details the purpose of the memorandum and the technical details of the memorandum, so that we would avoid more elaborate discussions mm-hmm. in the main cabinet. So, because in the main cabinet, ministers are there alone. They don't come with their permanent secretaries or their experts. And sometimes they go and meet other ministers who are more knowledgeable subjects than themselves, and they cannot answer. But in the committee, the experts come and are able to take the members through the entire document so mm-hmm. that members are convinced. And this, therefore, spared the main cabinet the time of having to go into details.
Yeah.
So the minister would just move the document, explain briefly to members the purpose of the bill
mm-hmm.
or the policy document. And then I would inform the president that we have already discussed this matter extensively in the
mm-hmm.
committee.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are a member who has got certain concerns can raise other than members of the committee, and then it will be explained. That way we are able to do business much faster.
Yeah. And in terms of that process whereby cabinet memorandums, the memorandums from the ministries were actually drawn up,
mm-hmm.
what were the kind of measures or standards that you put in place, if there were these standards, to make sure that ministers were clear as to what the requirements were when you were presenting memorandum to cabinet? How did you approach that whole issue?
We first, let me go back.
Mm-hmm.
When we first started, it became necessary to have a meeting first of the cabinet ministers with their permanent secretaries so that we could discuss the framework of the work of the cabinet, government generally,
yeah.
how we wanted to run the government. So we held a workshop
mm-hmm.
at the Kenya Institute of Monetary Studies, where we brought in experts to try to explain to the ministers and the permanent secretaries how we intended to run the government or how the government should run.
Mm-hmm.
As a preamble to that discussion, first, these experts talked generally about how to run an efficient government system. Mm-hmm. What are the weaknesses of the previous regimes and so on, and how make improvement of them.
Mm-hmm.
I then myself presented a paper, and because my view was that you need to have a clear vision yourself, which direction you want to take the country.
Yeah.
And I had heroes, or Lee Kuan Yew, former Prime Minister of Singapore and did a book from first to third world, from third to the first world. I had a copy of it and I told members that this is the experience and this is a must reading for every minister and the permanent secretary, how they were able to transform a third world economy, just an island outpost there, from a third world to first world.
Mm-hmm.
What are the measures that they took? And I told him that this is the direction that we need to go to move this country from where it is to where it should go, okay? And then I now went on to explain, and all that is in the paper that I presented to the members, and then initiated debate among the permanent secretaries and ministers so that they could actually own it.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the president also spoke, was very supportive of what I had said. And he said, look, there is nowhere where you just go to learn how to do it. You must make yourself be very clear what you want to do and how you want to do it. And we told them there had been a lot of wastage in the country through corruption, and that we intended to fight corruption very, very strongly. So that, secondly, time management was very important. A lot of man hours is wasted. People do idle chat or talk, so people report late to work, others report on time but just sit down there and reading newspapers, doing nothing. So you're not able to quantify what somebody has been doing the whole day. That this was really the work of them, and that as the permanent secretaries who are charged with the responsibility of management, they must themselves be disciplined and to be able to instill this discipline across board up to the shop floor. Then, so once we agreed now on the framework of how we wanted to run the government, then we tasked them, each one, to prepare strategic plan for their ministries. So, and we gave a deadline that within 1 month, maximum 2 months, we must have a strategic plan for each ministry. Okay? And that strategic plan will be reviewed by experts in my office with the Prime Minister, setting goals. Then we also established what he called performance contracting system, which had not been there. We working with the office of the British Prime Minister, I went to London. And I had discussions with Mr. Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister. And then he introduced me to the head of the Prime Minister's delivery unit and asked them to give us my office the support.
Yeah.
And they actually gave me experts who came here. And through their working with them and my team, they first set up a strategic plan, and then we set up the Prime Minister's delivery unit here, and working together with the department we established our performance contracting, because we had performance contracting as a department and office of Minister, the Prime Minister, headed by a permanent secretary. They worked out a system of evaluating the performance. First of all, each ministry, having prepared a strategic plan, they will then now come and sign a performance contract with the Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And that was done publicly. We would go to the place called Kenyatta International Conference Center. And the media would be invited there. Mm-hmm. And each minister will sign, and the permanent secretary sign, and the prime minister countersigns. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that usually took half a day. Once that was done, then now they now go on their own to implement. Then we now establish a system of doing performance evaluation. So the performance contracting department would hire experts, mm-hmm. consultants from the universities, from the private sector, and who would go and do performance evaluation. Once this is done, then now there will be now an occasion when the result will be released. Mm-hmm. Again, this was done publicly, the same venue. Now, this time, the president will come as well. If you now read the results.
Mm-hmm. This is proposal.
Hello?
I'm just wondering, in this whole approach of implementing the performance evaluation system, surely you encountered opposition there. How did you go about reaching a consensus or an agreement? Because I can imagine ministers from the other side of the divide, as it were, were perhaps not too happy to have themselves be evaluated by your office. So how did you go about forging that consensus to actually have people buy into this system?
You see, first, the cabinet meeting, I actually raised the issue that we must run one government. And the president actually read the riot act to his team, mm-hmm. and told them that they must obey whatever I tell them, and they must work under me, and that there will be no other government. If they didn't want, they have option of quitting.
Okay.
So that way he managed to help to instill discipline. Mm-hmm. And therefore, all those ministers were answerable to me.
Okay.
Fully. And what I made sure of was to ensure that there was neutrality. I did not give any preferential treatment, mm-hmm. Towards my ministers, okay. over the others. Mm-hmm. And that this evaluation was done professionally, mm-hmm. by independent people, mm-hmm. whose integrity was above board.
Okay.
Usually we had university professors. We had private consultants, mm-hmm. from reputable firms, mm-hmm. like PricewaterhouseCoopers, and so on, mm-hmm. and management consultant companies. So they did a professional job as a team. Mm-hmm. And the sectors were categorized. Mm-hmm. We had the ministries, as I mentioned. Then we had universities, public universities. Then we had state parastatals, uh-huh. state corporations.
These were all signed up for performance contracting.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Then we had local governments, mm-hmm. okay, which were all being evaluated. Mm-hmm. So the result would be, like ministries, will be evaluated from number 1 to number 42, mm-hmm. okay? Then the universities equally, mm-hmm. number 1 to number X, the last. Then the parastatals, mm-hmm. state corporations, will also be evaluated separately. Then the local governments will be evaluated separately.
Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
So then they will give reasons, mm-hmm. Why? So we have now had an award system where number one, number two, and number three would get trophies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And this, and then of course it will be number 39, so number 40, 41, 42.
Yeah.
So what happened? This creates a sense of competition.
Mm-hmm.
Because from there on, there will be debates in the ministries as to why they were this, the permanent secretary and minister would convene a meeting to find out why the ministry performed poorly. There would be a lot of arguments.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, we found that it had the desired effect. Because the following year, you will see changes. The biggest one was the office of the Attorney General,
mm-hmm.
which had been the last performance, and came first in the subsequent performance, one year later. And but then the other ministries which complained that wrong criteria mm-hmm. were being used
okay.
to rate them, like Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Complained bitterly
mm-hmm.
that they had been unfairly rated because most of their services are outside the country.
Okay.
To evaluate and so on. But there are systems that have been used in other countries
mm-hmm.
to do that kind of evaluation. I think the Indian system is, I think, the best.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't we want to be evaluated subsequently,
mm-hmm.
but we forced them to accept,
right.
to remain in the system.
If we step back a little bit from this maybe, and go to the issue of appointments, actually. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned in the beginning the process around appointing the ministers initially
mm.
as something that clearly also reading about it stands out as an important event in the life of the coalition.
Mm.
Would you maybe talk about that a little bit, how that process worked, how you managed to appoint ministers and also divide the portfolios?
First, dividing portfolios became a very contentious issue because the Accord had merely talked of 50-50 sharing and portfolio balance.
Mm.
But now to negotiate the nitty-gritty, who gets which ministry, you know, very contentious issue. And therefore, it delayed the formation of the cabinet.
Yeah.
This was a stalemate. And now the country was again very restive. The media was making a lot of noise that we were delaying unnecessarily. And then ultimately, the president sent someone to me. We held discussions and we agreed that he suggested we meet at a retreat, just the two of us. And I finally agreed,
mm-hmm.
and we flew to a secluded lodge, state lodge, a place called Sagana, and it was completely unused. It had never been used, that lodge, so nobody would even suspect that we would be going there. So we met there. I was only with one person. He also was only with one person. And after long, long haggling and so on, they agreed on what was thought a compromise. My people did not appreciate at that time when the friendship was announced, but later on they realized that we got probably the best in terms of service to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got the Ministry of Water, we got the Ministry of Agriculture, we got the Ministry of Roads, we got the Ministry of Housing,
mm-hmm.
we got the Ministry of we shared education. We got health, but partially shared, but the bulk of it went to us. Because they got finance and defense and internal security.
Yeah.
So, but then now we put names to the ministries, then. And
at the same retreat, at this lodge.
Same retreat. Yeah, yeah. There's some names the president did not quite like on my list, but he had to give way because I had also commitments to my people, which I was not willing to betray.
Mm-hmm.
So when we came back, we announced the cabinet. There are those people who were disappointed, and those who were happy.
Mm-hmm.
And this will always be the case. You will not be able to satisfy everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But that is how we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we now had now the responsibility of making this to become a team.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually like selecting a football team. Names, so on. Then now you have to know make them
play together.
Play together.
Exactly. So I can imagine also that also later on in the process that the issue of the dismissal of ministers, for example, and certainly there were moments of controversy, perhaps obstacles that you encountered later on when. Ministers were dismissed, but then there was a disagreement between you and the president. Can you talk a bit about how that played out and how you sought to overcome these obstacles that later came across the road?
Yeah, you see, there were occasions when there were quite a bit of tensions or a bit of unexpected situations.
Mm-hmm.
Which puts the coalition in a very difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like when the Minister for Finance was forced to step aside over the disposal of sale of one of the assets of where the state had stake.
Mm-hmm.
The president was under a lot of pressure. First, the minister had said he was not going to resign. This is called Mr. Amos Kimunya, then Minister for Finance. But the pressure became too much that ultimately the president asked him to step aside. And he did step aside. Then now the president had a big problem because he did not have in his team, an economist or a financial expert who could replace this minister.
Mm-hmm.
And then he could also now not take one of my people. Now he could not bring in a new person because the minister had just been suspended pending investigations. So I had, of course, better qualified people who could easily replace or act in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not, instead he now brought in somebody else who is not a financial person,
mm-hmm.
president, as Minister of Finance.
Okay.
One case. The other case was when some ministers had been mentioned in some improprieties,
mm-hmm.
Financial improprieties, and the more investigation needed to be done. It required that these ministers should actually step aside.
Mm-hmm.
But they were not stepping aside. And I knew that the president was under a lot of pressure. So I decided to take this. I discussed it with him, but he was not, he was reluctant. Mm-hmm. There was too much public pressure. So I decided to act alone and suspend these ministers. Then, because there was the pressure on the president, so he said that the accord said that there would be consultations mm-hmm. between the two of us, and that he had not had sufficient consultations, mm-hmm. and therefore he reversed the decision.
Yeah.
But at least I had been exonerated from blame, because mm-hmm. there was a little blame that we were tolerating corruption in the government. Those moments like those did bring some tensions.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was the appointment of people to constitutional offices. When the new constitution now came into life, there was a requirement to appoint the new chief justice, because the old one was supposed to retire by a certain date.
Yeah.
The new attorney general, the new director of public prosecutions, and the director of budget. Those four positions. Now, the president was a lot on the president to appoint some people who, according to them, were user friendly. But these are very strategic positions. Chief Justice, the Attorney General, the Director of Public Prosecutions. That is what we call the criminal justice system. And then the Director of Budget. So I happen to have been out of the country in Addis Ababa, attending an AU meeting. And the president tried to reach me on phone, but I was in a meeting.
Okay.
And then, consequently, he then decided to make appointments of some individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I came back, I disowned the... You know, I was asked when I was in Addis Ababa if I had been consulted. And I said, no, I had not been consulted.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came back, I was confronted by the press, and I said, no, I had not been consulted. The law requires consultations, and I hope that we'll do this. The names were supposed to be submitted to Parliament, and the President decided to submit the names to Parliament without even the name going through my office.
Mm.
And I was the chief government spokesperson in Parliament. In Parliament, there was always what they call the Prime Minister's question time, 1 hour every Wednesday, when I went to Parliament to make a policy statement and answer questions from members. So I wrote to the Speaker and disowned the list which was forwarded and said that this had not gone through the due process as stipulated in the accord.
Yeah.
And it became a major issue. The Speaker had to make a ruling on it. Ultimately, the Speaker ruled in my favor that indeed there was a mandatory need for consultations.
Mm-hmm.
And he even went on to define what consultation means.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that you make a phone call to somebody and yeah. I'm consulted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It has to be in writing.
Right.
So the appointment had been nullified.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we put in motion a process of competitive recruitment of the of officers through interviewing, through a panel set mm-hmm. up. And when that happened, only the Attorney General, who was an original list of the President, ended up being selected. Chief Justice
mm-hmm.
was dropped, a new one was selected, the current one. The Director of Public Prosecutions
mm-hmm.
was another one. And the Director of Budget was another person altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so you in a way you shifted the locus of decision making to this panel away from perhaps just the consultations between
yes,
the two principals.
The president man would go and look at person and say, this man can serve our interests for the name of the president.
If we could talk quickly maybe about the relationship you had in managing the cabinet with the secretary to cabinet, because you mentioned also in the book this phenomenon of the presidential circulars and the kind of perhaps tension and competition that there was between your two offices, the cabinet secretary and the prime ministers. How did you end up coming to a point where you could have shared priorities in the cabinet to make it function as well?
You see the president had run a cabinet for 5 years before this grand coalition. So I was one of his ministers. And that we were supposed to be a coalition. But then they did not run into the coalition. We had signed an MOU of power sharing, which was just dismissed. They said that was just a piece of paper. That was not even what the paper was written on. So the run is as purely a single party government. This is where we disagreed first. That's the reason why this time around we insisted that it must be entrenched in the constitution. So the way they run that government, you see, the president appoints the ministers and gives you an appointing letter which spells out your responsibilities as a minister, and then the do's and don'ts and so on. So, but now this other time things were different because we had accord signed and entrenched in the constitution. Then so I was then surprised when I received the letter from the president appointing to appoint me as a prime minister and then spelling out my duties, my responsibilities. You know, I'm supposed to be a co-principal and an equal partner. So I took exception at this development and told him as much and say that he should not spell out my terms of employment just like I should not be spelling out his terms of employment. We agree and then give instructions. And then we put in writing. That is what first caused the misunderstanding between us. But we were eventually able to iron it out, okay? Because they wanted to treat me as the vice president. See, in fact, lower than the vice president. They wanted the vice president, the second president, and then the prime minister in the kind of pecking order. But I took a good exception and said, no, the prime minister is a co-partner, it's a co-principal. So it's not a prime minister in the true sense, in the sense of the word. I'm a coalition partner with the president. Yeah. In fact, my party had more members of parliament and the president's party, okay? And I got more presidential votes than he did get. So therefore I should be the senior partner, but I left him to be the head of state. I said I could not be third in command. There was, that I was willing to accept was to be number two in the pecking order because the president was also doubling as a head of state. So I said, but the Prime Minister must come after me. So well, we had to actually make a public challenge to this because they are insisting. And I remember one public function in the Rift Valley, two of them, when I was being invited first to speak, and then invite the Vice President, who then invite the President. I said, no, as a co-principal. They had done it several times. I said, one day, just take a stand and correct it publicly and said, the Vice President should be called first. Then they insisted. Then when I went to speak, by the time I finished, I called the President. So when the President went there, he then called the Vice President to speak again. So the media noticed it,
Through
the discussions. Ultimately, they decided to change it. Now, the Vice President would go speak, would invite me to come and speak. And then, after that, then he would invite the President to speak, so he would act as an MC.
Two more quick questions. How do you see the role of the international community? You mentioned the international experts you had from the UK. Generally, how did you view their role? Was it the positive one? Did it help you in achieving the kind of results you wanted? And maybe after that, you can just offer a few reflections on how you thought Cabinet actually operated. Did service delivery improve? Did governance improve under the system that you had? What would you have done differently, perhaps?
First, in conflict resolution, when we had the turmoil in the country, I think the international community acted well and fast. The first person to call me was Gordon Brown, who offered assistance in mediation. Then there was the former German foreign minister who also called me. Then I received a call from Condoleezza Rice. And then I also received a call from a senator then, Barack Obama, who all urged that you need to desist from escalation and that you should give negotiation a chance. Gordon Brown is the one who first suggested Kofi Annan, and then there was then former Sierra Leonean Prime Minister Tejan Kaba, and then eventually asked Nani John Kufuor, then Ghanaian president, to come. Who came, and then after talking, then he recommended Kofi, who had initially had been rejected by the other side, but eventually accepted. Then other African heads of states, former President Mkapa, former President Kaunda, from Masire, Botswana, Desmond Tutu, Bishop, they all came here. So I was just want to say in a nutshell that the international community support was.
Right.
Condi Rice came.
And even after the actual signing of the agreement, did these people stay involved in some way? Did they continue to offer support to you?
Yeah, they were offering support. Was the times I visited the UK formally received by the Prime Minister. So I came to the US, met with President Obama. I had a meeting with President Kikwete. Kikwete actually came before, on the day of signing of the accord, he was here. I had a meeting with the then Egyptian president, that's the time, Hosni Mubarak. And the German Chancellor Angela Merkel came here for a visit. So and the French then Prime Minister also met with. So generally, the international community was engaged and was supportive. Mm-hmm.
And if we look back at the, like I said, the governance side of that coalition government. What are your thoughts on how the cabinet functioned? And we mentioned these challenges and some of the obstacles that you also later encountered. How do you look back on it? How do you assess it?
You see, I mentioned it initially that it was a bloated cabinet because of special circumstances under which it was made. But if you go back into Kenya's history, everybody will tell you that this was the most proactive cabinet, and in terms of even service delivery, I tell you that a lot was done in the period of the Grand Coalition government than at any other time in post-independence history of Kenya.
And why do you think that was? Because surely the odds were stacked against you with all the other elements involved. Why do you think it worked out that way?
Because I think there was also competition within the coalition, which ministers were delivering better than the others. So the ODM side, or the PNU side. So everybody wanted it, we didn't want to let his side down. The PNU ministers did not want to let Kibaki down. Neither did the ODM ministers want to let me down.
And since they had a kind of objective measurement of their performance, instead of having more conflict, perhaps because of not wanting to let you down, they channeled this maybe in a constructive way, because that kind of competition surely could have been negative as well, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think, see, again, because you separate things here, because the president was now left with other works of governance, like issues of, opening ceremonial things, like opening institutions, you mean talk here and there. And then I was doing the management, the day-to-day running the government, and being hands-on to ensure that all the ministries were working. Then we also had a think tank that I might mention, the National Economic and Social Council, NESC, which we had formed earlier to come up with bounce ideas on development and also troubleshooting. So we put in there experts from outside the country and also in the country. We had, for example, an expert from Singapore, another one from Malaysia, another one from South Korea, and then we had locally from Kenya, from the private sector, the Kenya Private Sector Alliance, senior bankers, like it was chaired by Mr. James Mwangi, who is the MD of the Equity Bank, one of the biggest banks around here. We had professors from the university, people from research institutions, and cabinet ministers, some cabinet ministers from strategic ministries. Was sitting there.
Okay.
It was co-chaired by the President and the Prime Minister. But the way things worked out, the President only opened it. Each year would come at least once. But I would chair most of the sessions. It was meeting every quarterly to meet, to review the situation. So it is the one that came up with the things like standard gauge railway.
Okay.
There's Lamu Port, South Sudan, Ethiopia Transport Corridor. The idea of special economic zones. The new airport that is now under construction, called Greenfield Airport.
And these ideas fed into the cabinet meetings, the committee meetings that
yes,
you had.
Yes, what happened? These meetings there, we come up with the ideas. First, we'll make presentation. For example, we'll just look at energy. We will have some experts talking about energy, and we'll subject this to discussion. Before that, thatness is what had helped us to set up what's called Vision 2030, which is the main blueprint for development in the country. How do you know that is now our destination, 2030? How do you get there? This is what you want. You want the country to be a middle income economy by 2030. What is it that must be done to reach there in terms of infrastructure, roads, water, housing, energy, and so on and so forth? What should be our generation capacity? And how should we be getting there?
How
about industrialization?
What
should that be? So that had been actually coined by the NESC.
Okay.
So now, once it is now there, we'll say this next meeting we'll talk about energy. And there now, a paper will be presented. You look at it. What are the options that we have? You've got hydro. How much can we generate through hydro? So much is the potential. What about other fossil fuels, thermal? How about the renewables? See, this geothermal potential, the Rift Valley, it's through NESC that we said we must exploit it properly. The wind, the solar, the biofuels, and then how do you raise funding for these kind of projects? All those were ideas which were being bounced at the
originated
from the NESC level.
Yeah,
and even roads. How do you roll a road network in the country? Then the water, irrigation. You see some of the projects that this government is now trying to implement were all conceived at that time. Because NESC was meeting regularly, they would help us dealing with emergencies, like when the meteorological department had predicted, for example, El Nino coming, then must be preparations. In the office of the Prime Minister, we had disaster management committee. So we would come up with the intervention measures that were required to deal with the possible consequences of El Nino. Drought is coming. We expect that this year you're only going to be able to harvest so many million bags of strategic foods like maize, like wheat, like vegetables, and so on and so forth. How do we deal with this? How much maize do we need to import? So that we do not run out of supplies at a certain time, and how do you raise the funding? You're facing this financial crisis. We had people, like in my office, had an advisor, Professor Hino from Japan, had gotten from a friend that told me that he had been here in the 90s. He was working with the World Bank. He's the guy who had actually unearthed one of the biggest scandals, financial scandals in the country, called Goldenberg. So I met this lady called Professor Ogata. Madame Ogata was the head of JICA, the Japan International Cooperation Agency, at a meeting in Cape Town, and told her that I was looking for Professor Hino, who used to be working here but is now in Japan. 2 days later, she was in Nairobi from Cape Town, and she called me and told me that she's at the Japanese embassy, but she has struck Professor Hino. He's teaching at Kobe University in Japan, but she's able to release him. So she, when she gets back to Japan, she'll release him. So Hino came here and worked for me for that period of time. Mm-hmm. And it was a real asset.
Mm-hmm.
Having been at the World Bank and here in the country.
Yeah.
And whenever we faced financial crisis, he would advise the Treasury.
Yeah.
And this is how to deal with A, B, C, D.
Interesting.
So when he left the government, I left him there. He's the one also who used to work as an advisor at the NESC. But after 6 months, he told me, I'm leaving because nobody needs me here. I'm wasted. So he left, he went to Yale.
Okay.
You know, he's been teaching at Yale. Last year, I found him there. Now he's gone to Cape Town.
He's in Cape Town now?
Yeah, he's in Cape Town now. And another disappointing thing is that NESC has never met ever since we left the government.
Mm-hmm.
I hear the last NESC meeting is like completely abandoned.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's also another secretary called Vision 2030.
Mm.
Secretariat, which is almost now just limping.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm. Any final thoughts, if you had to give advice to someone in your position today in a different country who has to now deal with these same issues of running a government, running a cabinet, making sure it delivers. Anything that we haven't spoken about that you think would be crucial for that person to know from your experience?
You see, it is very different running one unitary government or running a coalition. My experience here this time around was a coalition government where power was shared.
Yeah.
And we tried to make it as united as is possible to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that it may be easier if you are not doing a coalition government.
Yeah.
So, but my advice, those who will have the responsibility of running a coalition government, is that one, you must run it as one government. You must create a team out of the two teams so that it becomes seamless in order to be able to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
The ministers will see each other as partners, as colleagues, not as competitors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If there's competition, it should just be in terms of performance, but not because of this party.
Yeah.
Okay? Because that's what usually tears coalitions apart.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And the crucial thing that made them a team, what was that? Was that the agreement between you and the president that this is how it should be and there's no other way?
Exactly. I told the president that I know that you want to leave a legacy, because that I even said when we were finalizing the agreement. I said that I am the one who won the elections. The president lost it, but I'm ready to help him to create a legacy of a system that works, being the president who presided over transition from failure to success. If he gives me opportunity, I will show him how to do it.
show him how to do it and how not to do it. What must have is a complete trust that I'm well-meaning in this, because if he succeeds, I will also have succeeded. If he fails, we will have jointly failed.
Yes.
Therefore, he needs to give that trust. Mm-hmm. And he did give that trust. Mm-hmm. And he told his people. So, and it was generally known there that he would never contradict me. Mm-hmm. Whatever I'd said, mm-hmm. this is how to do it. And the ministers knew it. that he trusted my judgment, mm-hmm. and so I think that is important. Mm-hmm. That is a good advice.
Yes.
The other one is come up with a clear work plan, mm-hmm. a strategic plan, mm-hmm. so that each and every minister knows what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. That is irrespective of whether it's a coalition or it is a unitary government. Mm-hmm. So that you can be able to quantify the work.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll just be groping in the dark. Mm-hmm. You don't know where you're coming from or where you're going. I think that is very crucial to any government. Yes.
Your Excellency, thank you very much for talking to us. Mm-hmm. Just stop.